Welcome to the second part of Chapter 3 of our series, trying to answer the question, are we heading to a dystopian future? In this part, we will take a look at the societal and socio-political characteristics depicted in the novel Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. If you haven't seen or heard Part 1, you might want to go back and watch it. Also, this would be a perfect time to give this a thumbs up and maybe share it with someone. Or even use the links in the description to buy the book off Amazon or Audible and support my work. And with that, let's dive into Brave New World's societal and socio-political characteristics, starting with the all-time dystopian favorite, totalitarianism. The world state wields complete control over every aspect of people's lives. However, instead of using oppressive force, the government carefully engineers its citizens' biology, thoughts, feelings, and beliefs, as well as society's morals, norms, and class structure. The totalitarian nature of the government is derived from the totalistic ideology that drives it, called Fordism, which I've mentioned in Part 1. The socio-political stance of Fordism is summed succinctly with the motto of the world state: community, identity, stability. Community, as in your place in the larger whole; identity, as in the group identity of your caste; and all done in the name of maintaining social stability. These three pillars are set in place to advance a single goal: increase the economic efficiency and growth of the world state, much like the goal of a corporation. Indeed, to function and grow, companies require totalitarian control over all aspects of the ongoings within the company, from getting the right people to do the right job, how long they should work, how they should perform their job, what they should produce, how much, and so on. All these are controlled by the world state at a societal level. 2. Artificially mass-produced society. The society in Brave New World is technologically advanced. However, technology is used for one purpose and one purpose only: to produce an artificial and carefully engineered citizenry and culture. The citizens themselves are manufactured in insemination facilities and decanted from branches of fertilized egg clones, instead of being born. The world state biologically engineers their citizens' physique and intelligence, and psychologically conditions them from infancy according to specifications. Advanced pharmaceuticals are used to maintain health, prevent aging, and set an expiry date of sorts. And advanced psychiatric drugs keep the population content. Lastly, advanced forms of media are used to distract citizens and propagandize them. In short, people in the world state are decanted rather than born, conditioned rather than taught, indoctrinated rather than educated, and drugged rather than counseled. Or, as it explained to John the Savage, they are well off, they're safe, they're never ill, they're not afraid of death, they're blissfully ignorant of passion and old age, they're plagued with no mothers or fathers, they've got no wives or children or lovers to feel strongly about, they're so conditioned that they practically can't help behaving as they ought to behave. And if anything should go wrong, there's Soma. End quote. To elaborate, the technological means to achieve the world state's goals include the following. Biological manufacturing is manifested in the mass production of genetic clones and engineering fertilized eggs and fetuses by introducing chemicals and environmental variations based on the designated caste and the job they will be required to do. Or as it is celebrated by a high-level official in the book, the principle of mass production at last applied to biology. End quote. Psychological conditioning takes two primary forms, hypnopedia and Pavlovian conditioning. Hypnopedia, or sleep teaching, conditions people's subconscious from the second they are born, or rather decanted. Ever since they are babies, when they are asleep, citizens of the world state are exposed to recordings that reinforce the values and beliefs of society, such as the importance of consumerism and the idea that their predetermined social roles are natural and desirable. An interesting fact that the book mentions about hypnopedia is when one of the main characters talks about it, remarking, "Sleep teaching was actually prohibited in England. There was something called liberalism. Parliament, if you know what that was, passed a law against it. The records survive. Speeches about liberty of the subject. Liberty to be inefficient and miserable. Freedom to be a round peg in a square hole." End quote. The last sentence is crucial as it explicitly states that efficiency is the ultimate goal that motivates the world state to create this seemingly utopian society, while freedom is an obstacle to that goal. As a side note, this is something which I believe the Klaus Schwab gang seem to have in common with the world state. Other than hypnopedia, the other primary tool is Pavlovian conditioning. To shock us into it, very close to the start of the book, Huxley describes the following conditioning session performed on babies of the low Delta caste, which is just one caste above the lowest caste, Epsilons. And this is how the shocking scene unfolds. Rose balls and books were duly set in the nursery, opened invitingly, each at some gaily colored image. The babies began to crawl towards those clusters of sleek colors. From the ranks of the crawling babies came little squeals of excitement, gurgles, and twitterings of pleasure. Then the head nurse pressed down a little lever. There was a violent explosion. Shriller and ever shriller, a siren shrieked. Alarm bells maddeningly sounded. The children started screaming. Their faces were distorted with terror. Then the head nurse pressed the electric shock lever. The screaming of the babies suddenly changed its tone. There was something desperate, almost insane, about the sharp, spasmodic yelps to which they now gave utterance. Their little bodies twitched and stiffened. Their limbs moved jerkily as if to the tug of unseen wires. Later, at the approach of the roses, at the mere sight of those gaily colored images of Pussy and Cuckoo-Doodle-Doo and Baba Black Sheep, the infants shrunk away in horror. The volume of their howling suddenly increased. Books and loud noises, flowers and electric shocks were compromisingly linked, and after 200 repetitions of the same or similar lesson, They will be wedded indissolubly. They'll grow up with instinctive hatred of books and flowers, reflexes unalterably conditioned. They'll be safe from books and botany all their lives. End quote. So I assume it's pretty clear how this Pavlovian conditioning works, and hopefully how cruel it is. An insidious use of technology and psychology to suppress human nature. However, while keeping deltas away from books has an obvious, understandable end, what's the story with flowers, you might ask? Why condition them to hate flowers? Well, Huxley made sure to explain. If the children were made to scream at the sight of a rose, that was on the grounds of high economic policy. Not so very long ago, a century or thereabouts, gammas, deltas, even epsilons had been conditioned to like flowers in particular and wild nature in general. The idea was to make them want to be going out into the country at every available opportunity and so compel them to consume transport. But love of nature keeps no factories busy. It was therefore decided to abolish the love of nature, but not the tendency to consume transport. For, of course, it was essential that they should keep on going to the country, even though they hated it. The problem was to find an economically sounder reason for consuming transport than a mere affection for primroses and landscapes. It was duly found. We now condition the masses to hate the country, but simultaneously to love all country sports. End quote. So again, we see this manufacturing and conditioning of people for the sole purpose of economic growth. Next, in our human engineering toolset, we get to pharmaceuticals and drugs. Advanced pharmaceuticals, such as anti-aging agents, are used to preserve citizens at prime health, preventing any form of disease until they reach what could only be described as an expiry date. There is a telling part where, after Bernard's love interest sees an old man in the Savage Reservation for the first time in her life, Bernard explains why in their world, nobody, no matter how old, doesn't look like the old savage she saw. We don't allow them to be like that. We preserve them from diseases. We keep their internal secretions artificially balanced at youthful equilibrium. We don't permit their magnesium-calcium ratio to fall below what it was at 30. We give them transfusion of young blood. We keep their metabolism permanently stimulated. So, of course, they don't look like that. Partially, he added, because most of them die long before they reach this old creature's age. Youth almost unimpaired till 60, and then, crack, the end. End quote. As you should expect by now, here too there's an ulterior motive. Old age isn't made obsolete to make people happier. It is abolished, or cured, to ensure people remain productive workers and avid consumers. And the same goes for the use of drugs. To quote the book, "The old men work, the old men copulate, the old men have no time, no leisure from pleasure, not a moment to sit down and think, or if ever, by some unlucky chance, such a crevice of time should yawn in the solid substance of their distractions, there is always soma, delicious soma. Half a gram for a half holiday, a gram for a weekend, 2 grams for a trip to the gorgeous east, 3 for a dark eternity on the moon. Returning, whence they find themselves on the other side of the crevice, safe on the solid ground of daily labor and distraction, scampering from feely to feely, from girl to pneumatic girl. End quote. The soma mentioned in this paragraph point to the fact that pharmaceutical interventions are not confined to curing the body, but also curing the mind. Soma is a psychiatric drug that acts as a panacea against all forms of discomfort. Soma suppresses emotions and negative thoughts, ensuring that citizens stay content and in line with the government's principles and, obviously, productive. The feelies mentioned in the quote brings us to media and art. Technology is also leveraged to propagandize and distract the population with advanced forms of media. These include a futuristic version of movies called feelies, and a futuristic version of music played on the scent organ. Notably, both these mediums emphasize stimulation and provoking overwhelming sensations rather than being thought-provoking or introspective, thus making the individual less critical and more suggestive. Now, let's go back to our main list of social characteristics. And at number 3, we have class division. As mentioned previously, the society in the world state is divided into several different classes or castes, each having specific roles and responsibilities. Importantly, these classes don't represent socio-economic entities like in our world. Instead, they are biologically engineered and psychologically conditioned to fit job requirements. There are 5 castes in the book. At the top, you have the alphas, who are mostly portrayed as bureaucrats, managers, directors, heads of departments, specialists, and so on. Under the managing alphas, you have the professional classes in diminishing order of cognitive capacity, the betas and gammas, and at the very bottom, the hard laborers, the deltas and epsilons. A telling paragraph in the book summarizes how the engineering of each caste plays out. An alpha decanted, alpha conditioned man would go mad if he had to do epsilon semi-moron work. Go mad or start smashing things up. Alphas can be completely socialized, but only on condition that you make them do alpha work. Only an epsilon can be expected to make epsilon sacrifices for the good reason that for him they aren't sacrifices. End quote. Going on, we get to number 4, repression of individuality. Given the engineered caste system consisting of biological clones, it is obvious that individuality is not exactly held in high regard in this society. People are subtly forced by various means, some of which I discussed, to conform to the group's expectations, and those who do not fit in are punished by society itself, or, if needed, banished by the world state. The most obvious, in-your-face example of anti-individualism is that each caste is made to wear the same color uniform, and of course, the fact that humanity consists of groups of identical genetic clones. However, the number of clones per specimen is limited due to technological limitations, which one of the top bureaucrats lamented as limiting efficiency. In other words, individuality is perceived as inefficient by the world state and consequently considered immoral by society. At number 5, we get to the central one. Consumerism. Consumerism, or as the book calls it, conscription of consumption, is one of the main goals of the world state. As also mentioned above, regarding the conditioning of deltas to like flowers and later sports to encourage consumption of public transport. Therefore, the world state conditions society to view consumption as a means of pursuing pleasure. Moreover, citizens are instructed to consume a certain amount of goods and engage in leisure activities. After all, what good is production without consumption? Every man, woman, and child, the book says, are compelled to consume so much a year in the interest of industry. Another method of promoting consumption is conditioning people to acquire new things rather than fixing old ones. In fact, one of society's cherished and ingrained mottos is "ending is better than mending." Or, when applied to clothes, "the more stitches, the less riches." This last mantra, repeated in Hypnopedia sessions, emphasizes that this is explicitly done to enrich society rather than make it happier. At number 6, we get to a dystopian favorite, censorship and propaganda. Let's start with censorship. The world state in Brave New World employs strict censorship and control of information, deciding what people can access and read. The world state censors books and other forms of literature that do not align with society's values, access to which is reserved to the topmost elites that control the world state. In addition, the government also limits access to history, or at the very least, conditions them to view historic ways of life as hideous and barbaric. Much like in Orwell's 1984, scrubbing history seems to be a central means of control. In fact, at the very beginning of the book, we encounter what is described as a beautiful and inspired saying of Ford himself: "History is bunk." Propaganda. While censorship and control over history is quite overt in Brave New World, propaganda is subliminal and subtle. The government uses media to control the thoughts and emotions of people by broadcasting a constant stream of propaganda and entertainment, and sporting activities are included in that. All are used to keep people distracted and compliant. Speaking of which, media and art play a significant role in the control of citizens in Brave New World. Art is not created. Instead, it is engineered, designed by psychologists to influence society's culture, encourage citizens to view the world in a certain way, and discourage dissenting thoughts and ideas. At number 7, we get another common dystopian future: surveillance. Surveillance is not conducted directly by the world state. However, monitoring citizens' behavior and actions is essential to ensure that they conform to societal norms. Therefore, surveillance is primarily achieved through informants, and people are encouraged to spy on their friends and colleagues and report any deviant behavior. Notably, The characters in the novel are not made explicitly aware of being watched and monitored at all times, as is the case in the novel 1984. On to number 8, we get to personal relationships, starting with sexual promiscuity. The society in Brave New World is based on the principle that everyone belongs to everyone else, and sexual promiscuity is encouraged. In fact, this ideal is so important, it is one that is ingrained in citizens through hypnopedia, which I've mentioned. To quote the book, "Everyone belongs to everyone else," the world controller concluded, citing the hypnopedic proverb. The students nodded emphatically, agreeing with the statement, which upwards of 62,000 repetitions in the dark made them accept, not merely as true, but as axiomatic, self-evident, utterly indisputable. End quote. The most obvious example of this is that sexual relationships must not be anything other than casual and without emotional attachment. People are encouraged, almost mandated, to engage in sexual activity with multiple partners. If someone deviates from that, it is considered immoral and strange. As I've mentioned, this is a central tenet of the world state society, and achieved through conditioning from birth, proving to us that it is, in fact, unnatural, at least as far as Huxley is concerned. People need to be brainwashed to accept sex as a means of pleasure and not for emotional attachment. But it is not just through hypnopedia, but also how children are brought up. Maybe one of the most disturbing portions of the book is how children are groomed into sexual promiscuity, as described in the following scene. Outside in the garden, it was playtime. Naked, in the warm June sunshine, 600 or 700 little boys and girls were running with shrill yells over the lawns, or playing ball games, or squatting silently in twos and threes among the flowering shrubs. In a little grassy bay between tall clumps of Mediterranean heather, two children, a little boy of about 7 and a little girl who might have been a year older, were playing very gravely and with all the focused attention of scientists intent on a labor of discovery, a rudimentary sexual game. End quote. Related to children, we get to the elimination of the nuclear family. Obviously, being cloned in facilities, there are no parents in the world state. The society is built on the principles of communal living and the absence of traditional family structures and relationships. Reproduction, as I've mentioned, is controlled by the government. Thus, pregnancy and reproductive sex are biologically prevented and considered immoral and disgusting. Describing the words of one of the world state controllers, Huxley writes, "Our Ford, or our Freud, as for some instructable reason he chose to call himself whenever he spoke of psychological matters, our Freud had been the first to reveal the appalling dangers of family life. The world was full of fathers, was therefore full of misery, full of mothers, therefore of every kind of perversion from sadism to chastity, full of brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, full of madness and suicide." End quote. This, of course, resonates beautifully with Jerome K. Jerome's words in his short story, The New Utopia, which we have previously covered. And now we get to the last item on our list. At number 9, View of Death. Maybe one of the most interesting aspects of the society in the world state is its attitude towards death. Society, as a rule, is focused on the present and the future, not on the past or the dead. For instance, other than Ford, ordinary citizens, including most alphas, are unaware of historical figures. Furthermore, graveyards and tombstones do not exist as bodies are cremated upon death. And death itself takes place away from the public eye in designated facilities. Additionally, production being a central goal, dead bodies are recycled for their chemicals, condensed out of the smoke that rises from the crematoriums. And even fear of death and aversion to it are conditioned out of people. To quote the book, death conditioning begins at 18 months. Every tot spends 2 mornings a week in a hospital for the dying. All the best toys are kept there, and they get chocolate cream on death days. They learn to take dying as a matter of course. End quote. In other words, death is associated with positive reflexes rather than negative ones, which, interestingly, is in contrast to old age, which is viewed with disgust. And with that, I'll see you in the next part, where we'll conclude our look at Brave New World and try to ascertain what Huxley is trying to warn us of and why. And remember, don't do to others what is hurtful to you, and don't let the bad guys win, and feel free to use the links below to support my work. And of course, thanks for staying to the end.